Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, acclaimed writer and laureate for Irish fiction, Colm Tobin, is here. Lovely to see you.
How are you?
Great to have you in with us. I was looking at an interview that you did in the Irish Times earlier in the year. You were talking about New York and how the pace of it maybe is a bit too fast for you sometimes, that your energy isn't there. Do you find that you come home to Ireland and you go, a little?
Yeah, but I think the energy in New York is exaggerated. I think it's a big myth about, you know, the city that doesn't sleep, and trying to get your dinner in New York in a restaurant after about 8:30 at night now. Oh, the kitchen's closed.
They're all gone. You know,
in other words, it's Manhattan especially is emptied out, and young people especially have gone to live in Brooklyn or in other places further away. The prices of apartments are too high, and there's a sense of emptiness in the city. So you could think it's the city that doesn't sleep and Dublin is sleepier, but it's actually not true, if you, especially the way Dublin's changing.
Yes.
That Dublin becomes a sort of busier city at certain times, especially at the night.
And you spend a bit of time in LA as well, don't you?
I do, yeah. But that's really sleepy. It's the sleepiest place on earth.
Yes,
it's a good place
to
work,
vibe,
you see,
though.
Because there's nothing else to do.
but work.
I mean, you can't, like, there's no pub to go drinking in. There's no cafe to go cafeing in. Mm-hmm. There's no, you just stay home. You just get on with your book.
So I said at the beginning of the programme, we have the author of the book of the summer coming in. Were you surprised by the success of Long Island? It was huge.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of it is related to the film. You know, that if you have a book that is in any way associated with something like the film of Brooklyn, then you get an audience that you mightn't get normally for a sort of, what we call a sort of literary novel, that it was helped enormously by John Crowley's film and Saoirse Ronan's performance.
Yeah, and
so that was another element.
When I saw you sitting down with Oprah, I thought, right, this one now, this book is, we're done. This has ticked all the boxes.
Yeah, she has a policy for her book club that she must speak to the writer directly herself.
Right.
And it must begin always in the same way, which is, you pick up the phone, or you, whatever, you don't pick up the phone anymore, you press a button on the phone and someone says, "This is Oprah Winfrey."
Right.
And for some reason, I realised immediately what this was. Because the publishers had been saying to me, "Could you start answering your phone? Could you actually, if you see a phone number, just answer?" But I had no idea what they meant. And then in a second, it came clear to me that she was about to, I don't know, everyone else seemed, she phones, goes crazy, gets really surprised, doesn't believe it, does all those things. But so I ended up having to go into the studio at about 5:30 in the morning, speaking of the city that doesn't sleep, because, you know, you have to get ready for the whole business of going live on. It's like being pulled out of a Christmas cake, or, you know, it's like the fairy on top of the tree. We have an announcement to make. And suddenly this old fellow gets wheeled on. I have to say that she was incredibly charming and easy to deal with, as were her team. You know, I did have to be up early. It was all made very easy.
But she clearly loves the books that she picks. So you're a lot of the way there with her, aren't you?
Yeah, she has a team of people who will read everything and work out, is there anything that she might like?
Mm-hmm.
And then they give her a good number of books and she picks one. And she picked this. And she was very funny one moment. She said, "You know something?" And I'm not going to do an American accent, but, "You know something? I hate Jim." And Jim is one of the characters in the book. And I get quite slightly defensive about these people. You know, like, I made them up. And she was looking at me as though we should all join forces in hating Jim. But she was passionate about this idea that Jim was the problem.
But you can't hate Jim.
Well, she does.
Yeah, well, there you go. Listen, you don't care who she hates as long as she promotes the book in the way that she did. Then one of the other things they did with you was they stuck you into Costco. The massive, do you even call it a supermarket? Like,
I don't know what you call Costco. You have to be a member, but it doesn't mean it's an exclusive club. It's a very popular place. In other words, on a Saturday, it's where large numbers of people go who have cars to stock up in things that, like toilet paper, all those sort of things you can buy in bulk. But as you walk around in your massive wheels, there's actually, you buy books. And so they picked my book this is before Oprah, you know. So a month before, I was doing interviews with Costco. And I got interested in Costco and said, you know, I've never been in a Costco. And you know, I don't need a mountain of toilet paper. I don't need kitchen paper. Every chickens, you know, massive cooked chickens. So I went in, and someone from the publishing house came in with me, and they just filmed me wandering around.
Oh, was it just such
and
a funny
it was done
video?
On a whim, coming back in from a reading on Saturday afternoon out on Long Island, we just said, "Let's stop in at Costco and just look at it." So I need to, you know. And she had a card, so we went in and went around, and I looked at the chickens, I looked at the free samples, I looked at the books, and she filmed it, and we edited it down, and we put it up on TikTok. And, you know, I don't have TikTok. Mm-hmm. But yeah, everywhere I go, instead of saying, "Are you the guy that wrote the book?" I say, "Are you the TikTok guy for Costco?" Yeah. And I am, yeah.
Do you know, when I watched that video, I wondered how you felt about consumerism, because I'm thinking about Eilish's mammy when she buys her the new appliances and she looks at them with disgust. And who's going to pay for these when you're long gone back to America? Do you sense that we still have an issue? Maybe it's a generational thing here with buying stuff.
Yeah, I think it's more that the generation before mine got really worried about the electricity bill.
Yeah.
It often came in the day you didn't expect it, and it was often higher than before. And the tumble dryer could become a contested space in any household. Who's using the tumble dryer? And that tumble dryer eats electricity.
Yeah.
And turn off that light.
We all heard that. You know,
I think we all lived on the idea the electricity bill was the enemy of the people. Now, of course, it goes straight into your account for a lot of people, and it just gets paid automatically by the bank. People don't think about electricity bills like they used to.
Well, we've been a little bit more worried about them of late with prices going up.
Yeah.
But there's a certain value in Ireland, or there was, maybe in the generation ahead of ours, a value in being frugal and having a bit of hardship, you know, is a badge of honour, wasn't it?
Yeah, in a way, Costco is the same idea, that you get things really cheap. And then instead of going around the corner each time you need something and paying more, you buy it all together, you know, in massive shopping. But it seems to me that you don't actually get it that much cheaper, because you end up with a garage filled with rubbish you don't want.
You know? But you might feel as though you got a bargain. Listen, you spoke a lot about politics, American politics, in the past. Now you seem to have thrown your hat at it, have you?
I'll be back soon. But, everyone watched the debate. And the feeling was that Kamala Harris won. But there's a strange thing that Trump was behaving like a buffoon for much of it. You're saying, "We're the best government ever, the best vice president ever, the best." But actually, if you look at what he did in his first term, he appointed 3 Supreme Court judges. And very few presidents get that chance in one term to appoint 3.
Mm-hmm.
The 3 he appointed were in their 40s. They're incredibly ideological. They're likely in the 60s, meaning in the 2060s, we will still be worried about what they're doing. You know, he left an extraordinary legacy. It was really, really well thought out. Who are the 3 people at the right age with the right amount of determination? Other Republican presidents appointed people to the Supreme Court who turned, you know, who went liberal suddenly on the court. These 3 didn't and won't.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to remember that this is a very deliberate person under certain circumstances, a buffoon under others. We have to take him very seriously. And my worry was that when I saw her sort of laughing at him, that there's an element of, well, you know, he must be the harmless one then, if you can laugh at him.
But that seems to be the Democratic strategy, doesn't it, this time out?
Yeah, I'd worry about it.
Project 2025, do you think that its existence, even though he has denied that that's his plan, but it was people who were in his former administration who came up with it, do you think that that makes a second term of Donald Trump for you more worrying?
Yeah, it's absolutely clear now. I mean, just look at the Supreme Court appointments and you realise that there is other work to be done, for example, on rolling back gay rights, rolling back women's rights, mm-hmm. and rolling back citizens' rights. So there are so many areas to be done with both the administration and the Supreme Court. I mean, the frightening one would be if he got the Senate and Congress, and if he had the presidency, that if they had all 3, then it would be a very different country in 4 years' time. So that the problem is, if you keep attacking him, it looks as though that's all you stand for. If you then issue your own policies, it looks as though you're not actually attacking him enough. It's a very difficult position for Kamala Harris, because she can't attack Joe Biden. She can't say, my my administration will be entirely new, entirely different. We will. So that she's in a quite difficult position, and in a way, the less she debates with them, in my view, the better. She's won the first one.
Yeah, but they've called for another one. The Democratic side have called for another one.
They're good at calling for one because they put it up to Trump to come on and behave like a buffoon again. But it's a very complex question as to how she conducts her campaign, how much detailed policy she goes into, how liberal she must seem for some people, and yet she must seem not too liberal for others. Fracking would be a small example of that, where she changed her position from 2020. And for a moment in the debate, it looked as though she actually almost wasn't going to admit that she'd changed her view. She talked about her values. When people talk about their values, I feel they're about to say something untrue.
Do you think she's the right candidate for the Democrats?
Oh, yeah, she's great. I think she's great. Well, I just think she's great.
If the Democrats had their ducks in a row a little earlier, though, they might have given the Democrats and the convention a choice, you know?
Yeah, I just
leaving it as late as they did, they limited themselves.
Yeah, I just can't see Josh Shapiro or Gavin Newsom actually be managing as well as she's managing to keep a sort of, just to suggest I'm new, I'm fresh, I'm young. And,
which is extraordinary
and I can be
trusted. Because she's not. You know, as you said there, she's part of the previous administration, but she's managing to create this sense around herself she is new.
She looks great on television, which really matters, as we know from Kennedy Nixon. Mm-hmm. You know, that she is the Kennedy in that debate. And I just hope that she can keep going on. There are small matters of policy that she must keep adding to, that she's someone who's not just coming in spreading joy. Mm-hmm. But that she is, and not just coming in with her legal experience as a prosecutor, but she's coming in with some idea that she will, that you will benefit materially from her presidency.
Listen, I'm distracted because all the messages are coming in about Long Island. People really want to talk about it. So Jesse Buckley, this person says, was amazing reading the audio version of Long Island. And Saoirse Ronan is going back now to do Brooklyn.
Saoirse has just done Brooklyn, so I think that's just out now.
Great. Yeah. How do you feel about audiobooks?
I love them, and it's great. Meryl Streep did The Testament of Mary. So I have Jesse Buckley, Saoirse Ronan and Meryl Streep. So notice me complaining.
Listen, some people, though, have an issue with them and they like to feel the books in their hands. Yeah. They also might have a problem with the narrator. Like, if you get that wrong, you're in trouble.
Yeah. And I feel that sometimes, too. If you're in a long car journey, you know, get the right book and it just lifts you.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Would you ever narrate one yourself?
I did. I did A Guest at the Feast, which is a book of essays.
Did you enjoy it?
And it's hard work in the studio. If your tummy, you know this, if your tummy rumbles, they come out and say, your tummy has just rumbled. Could you do that
again?
But you know, so there's a whole question of do it again, do it again, do it again.
The only criticism I have of Colin's latest novel is that it ended. I so enjoyed settling in every night before bed to read a chapter. Actually, can I talk to you about the ending? Because I did feel like the door was wide open to another one.
Yeah, I mean, it's an ending where Jim is uncertain. He is really destabilized. He's alone. He doesn't know what to do. And in a way, that's for me the ending. You know, in other words, it's a man left not knowing what to do. But if I give him, if I tell the reader everything, then I've ruined that idea that he's left there. Mm-hmm. Between two things, with two possibilities that seem, one of them seems closed. So, you know, there are several ways of looking at it, but I didn't want to tie everything up to say, over the next 20 years, this is how these characters lived.
But you might give us another installment.
You know,
she begs.
I don't have an idea in my head at the moment, honestly.
Claire, will you tell Colm the women from the Irish Pastoral Centre in Boston adored both Brooklyn and Long Island. You continue to tell their story of leaving Ireland as teenagers and their established life now in America. Thank you so much, says
great.
Trish. Isn't that
That's
lovely
great.
To hear?
Lovely.
I know you follow the news here closely. Well, you've been here over the last couple of months, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah.
So you'll know about the scoping inquiry into church-run schools. And there has been an extraordinary outpouring of storytelling on Liveline over the last few weeks. It has continued now for over 2 weeks. And this isn't about sexual abuse so much as physical abuse or people being told that they were worthless, they were stupid, they were dunces. What legacy is that going to leave in that generation? We're just hearing more and more and more.
All of us lived with it and it was treated as absolutely normal. And there's no question of saying everyone didn't know about it. Everyone knew. I mean, this physical abuse. And it was interesting to look back at the debate over getting rid of it. John Bolan, Minister of Education, Gareth Fitzgerald just in. But the two figures who really put pressure on that government to get rid of corporal punishment, to ban it, were Jim Kemmy and Noel Brown, who was a TD in 1981. Mm-hmm. But watching the teachers' unions, just look back at what the teachers' unions wanted in 1981. They wanted the right to be able to beat people. Mm-hmm. And the teachers' union should really look at this. I mean, I know it's, well, it's 43 years ago, but it seems recent to me. I couldn't believe in 1981 the pressures the teachers' union were putting on the government of Gareth Fitzgerald and Dick Spring to
to leave it in place.
Yeah.
When I listen to Liveline at the moment, I'm hearing the voices of people who are in their 60s, their 70s, sometimes their 80s. But what I'm really hearing is an 8-year-old child or a 12-year-old child who has just been hit that day or just been told that day that they're stupid and that they're worthless.
Yeah, I had to ask my auntie Kathleen what the word imbecile meant, because Brother Carberry told me I was an imbecile. And Auntie Kathleen said it was, well, it was somebody. And she just gave a big definition. And she said, why? And of course, I couldn't tell her because the brother just called me an imbecile. It was one of his words, but his words were fine. I didn't mind what they called me at all. But the beatings were really, really, this is Christian Brothers in Enniscorthy, were really horrific.
Mm-hmm. I asked Archbishop Diarmaid Martin, former Archbishop of Dublin, on this programme about something he said back in 2018 about why was the Catholic Church such a hard and harsh place in Ireland. And he says, even today, he says that question hasn't been answered. Would you be able to hazard a guess?
No, the lay teachers were worse, some of them. You know, there's no point in blaming the church for this. I mean, this was done, every teacher. Mm-hmm. Who certainly
You don't think it was culturally linked to the Catholic Church?
No, I think it happened in England as well. I think it happened in public schools in England. I think just beating children was just almost a sort of a, considered a human right almost. Mm-hmm. You know, and any of us who went through it realised that nobody put a thought into it at the time.
But you'd wonder how it affects that generation, yeah, and the generations afterwards. You know,
you see, it went right into the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And wasn't it a fantastic adjustment for those people to treat their own children with respect,
yeah,
when that was no longer acceptable, as so many of them did treat their children with yeah, great respect and love?
Yeah.
Well, Colm, it is wonderful to see you, as always. I had that message in from the women in the Irish Pastoral Centre in Boston about how you have always held to that story of telling people's journey through, you know, moving to America. Do you think that story is told now? Because we hear that life for young people who move to America is very different. You know, they're not working in service jobs. They're working for, you know, all sorts of fabulous tech companies and living in the glass-fronted apartments.
Yeah. We have very few novels about it because, I mean, Joe O'Connor wrote Star of the Sea, say, and I wrote Brooklyn because, of course, when people went to America, the last thing they wanted was to sit down and write a novel. So it was the next generation became writers, people like Henry James, Eugene O'Neill, you mm-hmm. know, as a playwright. But yeah, it's a story that still keeps waiting to be told because, as you say, each generation is different. And you notice that now. I mean, I went up to see the, I think it was Leitrim, no, it was Mayo actually playing against New York in Gaelic football. It was amazing to see just the sheer numbers of Irish, all of them born in Ireland and all of them living in the whole New York area. So it's still going on, this business of building an Irish America.
Yeah, probably having a very different life experience to the people who moved in the 50s and 60s yeah, and yeah, before. Now, you have a couple of projects coming up that I want to tell people about. So as part of your role as laureate for Irish fiction, you have a final lecture happening on the 3rd of November, Taking a Colour for a Walk. We used to take a line for a walk in schools. You're Taking a Colour for a Walk. Yeah. Tell us more about that.
Well, it's with Visual in Car. And my job was to go through, first of all, the Arts Council collection. The Arts Council over, I suppose, 60 years has gone into galleries. Say you're having a first exhibition and the Arts Council will buy one of the pieces. And then that will go to, say, a county manager's office first. But now more in hospitals or in offices generally, you see these pieces. I went through about 1,000 of them looking for an exhibition. Now, the problem is, what do you do with abstract art if you can't see it? So you see two colours, black and a bit of blue. And 20 years ago, if you'd said to me, I can't see what's in this, I can't see any depth, I know it's two colours. So what I've been trying to do is just look at these more carefully. I put together an exhibition of 20 paintings in Visual in Carlo that are mainly abstract, mainly just one colour and black often and another colour beside it. And just to see if you could train your eye just to look enough. Now, the thing is, if you can't do it, just move on. You can't do it. Mm-hmm. But maybe the next time, maybe something will stay in your memory. Like looking at a Mark Rothko painting, you think, that's beautiful. I'd love to have a print of that on the wall. It's so still. There's something moving and stillness in it. So I'm trying to work with that. And I'm giving a lecture about a sort of journey, a sort of trying to think about my own relationship to paintings and just the time I started to look at them and the different ways in which looking at paintings affected me. So that's what the lecture is. But the show is opening tonight. It's part of Culture Night and it's free, obviously. It's in Visual in Carlow. And the other thing I'm doing is, look, after Long Island, you know, decided that it was time to write a comedy where at the end, everyone is happy. Everyone. And how do you do this? And of course, the Wexford Opera Festival commissioned an opera based on Lady Gregory's trip to America. She went to America in 1911 with the Abbey Theatre. They got arrested for putting on Playboy the Western World in Philadelphia. So you have all the actresses, Lady Gregory, John Quinn, the lawyer. So you have 12 singers for an opera. Now, this is opening at the festival. It's opening on the 20th of October. And it's 12 singers. Mm-hmm. And I promise you at the end that you won't need to know anything more because they're all perfectly happy, smiling, mostly in couples, married. But I just decided for once, yes, stop writing these melancholy stories.
No gyms.
So it's called Lady Gregory in America. And everyone, I promise you, is happy.
Okay, and that's at the Wexford Opera Festival. Colm, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much. That's our Laureate for Irish Fiction, Colm Toby.